Welcome to the Pro Politics Podcast. I'm Zach McCrary. I've been working in politics for the better part of two decades, but at heart, I'm a political junkie who wants to talk to interesting people involved in politics. Today, I'm joined by David Axelrod, a major presence in American politics for the past 20 years, best known for his time as chief strategist for Senator, then President Barack Obama, since then a prominent television commentator at CNN, and until recently, the director of the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, with his own podcast, The Axe Files and Hacks on Tap, with Mike Murphy, himself a previous guest on this podcast. Instead of trotting on what is familiar ground for a lot of us in going deep on the Obama years, I wanted to spend my time with David today talking mostly about his work before the Obama era, the New York City kid who fell in love with politics, following that muse to Chicago, starting in journalism, then making the jump from the Chicago Tribune to a working political hack in the trenches for roughly two decades before he crossed paths professionally with then State Senator Barack Obama. Maybe there can be a part two of this discussion down the line, but for this conversation, I really want to sink my teeth into the Axelrod political origin story. David Axelrod, tell me a bit how you grew up.
First of all, great to be with you, Zach. I grew up in housing development in New York that was built for returning war veterans called Stuyvesant Town. Now it's quite different. It's a high-end rental property that is nothing I would have imagined when I was a kid growing up. We lived in a little apartment. I shared a room with my sister with a big divider between us. By the way, and I just have to get this off my chest, my sister was 6 years older than me, and she would throw stuff over the divider, and I would yell at her, and then my parents would come in and yell at me, and I'm still bitter about that. But it was there that I really got an interest in politics. John F. Kennedy was campaigning in 1960 for president, and on October 27th, 1960, he came to Stuyvesant Town, one of 10 stops he made in New York City that day. The woman who took care of me when my mom was at work, this wonderful woman named Jessie Berry, took me out to this event. It was in the middle of the day, and she put me on a mailbox, and I was like sort of transfixed by this young man jumped up on the platform, and he was speaking, and his voice was booming off the buildings, and everybody was watching in rapt attention, and people had flags, and it just seemed really important to me. And I mean, I was really kind of hooked from that moment. But I grew up in New York City, public schools, PS 40, junior high school, 104, Stuyvesant High School, very much the urban experience.
And at one time, I know you had a JFK impression. Could I impose on you to
It's too embarrassing. Everybody, when I was growing up, was doing JFK impressions because his Boston accent was so pronounced. I would do it with great vigor. But anyway, go ahead.
And you developed a passion for politics, for public service early on. But beyond some of those early memories you mentioned, the JFK memory, when did you feel yourself really falling in love with politics, feeling it as a calling?
As a calling is hard to say. That sort of came later. But, when I was a kid, by the time I was starting to read, we would have newspapers that were dropped at our apartment door, and I would grab them. And of course, I would read the sports section first. But I always used to look for stories and watch on the news stories about President Kennedy and what was going on in the civil rights movement. I had a great teacher in the first grade named Mrs. Roth, who probably she would have been fired under today's rules. But, she taught us about the civil rights movement and introduced us to, Martin Luther King and really piqued my interest in all of that. And then when I was 9 years old, Bobby Kennedy, this was after President Kennedy was assassinated, was running for the Senate from New York. So I handed out leaflets for him. I always tell people, Zach, that when I was 10, I broke with the Democratic Party because the New York City machine, Tammany Hall, had nominated a guy I thought was a hack for mayor. And I worked for a guy named John Lindsay, who was the Republican golden boy then, but a liberal Republican who you can probably see at, your local Museum of Natural History now that they don't exist anymore. But John Lindsay ran on the Republican and liberal party line, and I went and worked for him from the liberal party headquarters. My favorite recollection of that and my first introduction to real politics was some woman was so thought it was so cute that a 10-year-old was handing out leaflets for John Lindsay that she gave me this box of pastries that she had bought. She said, why don't you take these? So I took them back to the party headquarters when I was done, and they opened the box and there was all these donuts and a wad of cash for some reason in there. And so this guy with a cigar in his mouth said, okay, kid, you take the donuts, we'll take the cash. That was good preparation, actually, for Chicago politics.
Let me throw a name at you that is not a household name from this era, but seems like it might have been an important moment as you developed some of the nuance you developed about working in and around politics. And that name is Andrew Stein.
Yes. Yeah, Andrew Stein. So this was when I was 13 years old. One of my friend's parents was a Democratic precinct captain, and he was working for this guy, Andrew Stein, who was 23 years old and running for the state assembly. And Andrew's father, Jerry Finkelstein — Andrew shortened his name for ballot purposes — his father decided that he was going to elect his son, who was sort of a mediocre student at a mediocre college and needed a job. He was going to elect him. They were going to be the Jewish Kennedys, I guess. And he was going to elect him to the state assembly. And this guy was working for him. And they spent more money on an assembly race than had ever been spent, I think, nationally. And part of that money went to paying kids in housing developments like mine to put leaflets under every door because it was hard to get into these buildings. They paid, I think $3.50. It was a lot of money for that time. And my friends and I dutifully worked on this campaign. And Andrew Stein won. He defeated an incumbent assemblyman, a Republican. I think the guy's name was Vince Larkin. I remember my friend's father walking into the storefront headquarters on 14th Street, and my friends and I were there, and he said, Andrew won by 5,000 votes, and everybody cheered, and I didn't, and I realized, my God, we elected a dope to the state assembly. And, you know, I also, at the same time, that same year, Zach, I was working for Bobby Kennedy for president. And so it was really the sacred and the profane as far as I was concerned. But it was a lesson in politics. And one of them was, if you have enough money, certainly at some of the lower levels, that can make an awfully big difference.
And so you're developing these skills, developing these contacts in New York, local politicos, you know, on the periphery of the campaigns for Robert Kennedy, John Lindsay, local officials. So why leave New York for college and why Chicago?
Well, part of it was I had kind of a strained relationship with my mother. My parents were divorced. I needed to get out of town. I needed to get away. I had a great homeroom teacher. He was my physics teacher as well, named Jerry Liebner. And Jerry Liebner said, I'm not going to tell you guys anything about this whole college business except for one. If I were you, I would get a compass and draw a circle around the city of New York on a map, and I would choose any school that was 600 miles or more away from New York City, because your parents will never surprise you with a visit if they have to pay for a plane ticket. And I thought, well, there's a lot of homespun wisdom in that. But the University of Chicago was a great university. I knew that, and I went to see it, and it impressed me. But it also was the fact that Chicago was like a really intriguing political town. 4 years before I went to college, they had this 1968 Democratic convention that turned into a cataclysm where anti-war protesters clashed with police. It was the home of the last of the big city machines. Richard J. Daley was the boss of the Democratic machine. And Hyde Park, where the university was sort of the locus, the fulcrum of a nascent but growing independent political movement, Black independent political movement. And I thought, this would be a really interesting place to be. So that's why I went to Chicago. I really thought hard about leaving New York, and I had gotten into schools in New York. I just needed to get out of there, and I wanted to go to a place that I thought would be really stimulating politically.
You could talk at length about the politics of Chicago, but instead of asking you just to tackle such a big topic, let me just throw out a name or two to put on the tee, and you can maybe speak to why they are important components and symbols of the Chicago political scene when you came to town cutting your teeth. Let's start with a pretty well-known name, though more because of his Washington influence, and that is longtime Congressman Dan Rostenkowski. Yeah. What does his career speak to about the politics of Chicago?
Well, look, what was so interesting about Dan Rostenkowski he was an entirely different figure in Chicago than he was in Washington. In Washington, he was a serious policymaker, deal cutter, ultimately the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. You know, he was in Congress. He was on that committee when Medicare was passed and worked on that. So there was that Dan Rostenkowski. And back in Chicago, he was Dan Rostenkowski, son of Joe Rostenkowski, who was a ward boss himself. And Dan followed him. His father got him elected. I think he was an alderman, Joe Rostenkowski. His father got him elected to the state Senate in the 1950s and in 58 to Congress. I think he was in his 20s, maybe, when he got elected to Congress. But his job in Chicago was as a loyal ward boss, and he was a big cog in the Democratic machine. And so when I was a political reporter and others in Chicago, you know, we were talking to him about slate making and, you know, who he supported for county assessor and things like that. And by the way, at the end of his career, the White House and the mayor asked me to help Rostenkowski because he was under investigation, and that created political problems for him. Ultimately, he lost in 94 after he was indicted. He was the greatest storyteller about politics, storyteller about Washington, had obvious passion for it. He also was part of a different generation. So, you know, he was convicted for cashing in stamps, getting the cash for that. I suspect that back in the 50s when he went to Congress, that was probably a fairly common practice, but the mores and rules changed and he didn't change with them. And so this towering figure in American government and politics was defeated because he engaged in the kind of chiseling that you'd associate with an alderman in Chicago. It's really, it was a tragic story.
A less household name, but one that I believe may be telling in some different ways, is a woman, a Black woman, who also served in the Congress 70s, 80s, 90s, and that is Curtis Collins.
Oh, yeah. Well, Curtis Collins kind of went to Congress by accident, and literally by accident. Her husband, George, was the congressman from that district on the west side of Chicago. George Collins, I mean, just to go back, just to share some colorful Chicago lore, George Collins was the bodyguard for an alderman named Ben Lewis. George Collins, as the legend goes, went out to have a smoke one day and came back and found Ben Lewis dead of gunshot wounds, assassinated. George Collins then became the alderman of the 24th Ward and ultimately congressman. Now, this is another story that we'll never know because both of them are dead. But Mayor Daley, who ran the machine and every element of it, was thinking after George Collins died about who should replace him. Curtis Collins went in to speak with the mayor, his widow, and she went in to speak with the mayor, and she expressed an interest in that seat. The mayor had a different guy in mind, a guy named Madison Brown, who I think was the commissioner of rodent control for the city, but a loyal Democratic precinct captain and so on. And then Curtis, according to the legend, Curtis said, you know, Mr. Mayor, I don't know if I mentioned this, but George kept a diary. And whatever happened in that room, Curtis Collins emerged as the choice of the mayor and the Democratic machine for Congress, and she served for decades after.
Two small examples, two individual examples of the power of the Daley machine, the Democratic machine. An example of perhaps how it starts to fray is another prominent Black political figure of this era, something of a transitional figure, is Ralph Metcalf.
Yeah. Well, Ralph Metcalf was a really interesting guy. He was a track champion who he got the silver medal in Berlin in 1936 when Jesse Owens won the 100-meter race. Was on the relay team with Owens that won the gold medal, and came back a hero to Chicago and was embraced by the Democratic machine, became an alderman. And ultimately, when Bill Dawson, who was a legendary figure in Black politics in Chicago, the congressman, died, Ralph Metcalf was chosen by Daley to succeed Dawson and was very much a loyalist of the Democratic machine. And then in the early 70s, a close friend of Metcalf's, he was a dentist, I think his name was Dr. Odom, was beaten by police. He was stopped. I think it was a traffic stop, beaten by police. And Metcalf was outraged and he began agitating around the issue of police, excessive force by police, and ultimately called for a civilian review panel. This was heresy to Daley. Their relationship became more and more frayed. And in 1975, Metcalf endorsed Daley's reform opponent, Bill Singer, who was running, an alderman who was running against Daley, and did relatively well by Chicago standards. I think he lost 2-1. But the idea that Ralph Metcalf would break with Daley, no one even 5 years earlier would have predicted that. And the Black independent political movement grew up around Metcalf's defiance of Daley. And in 1976, Daley ran a candidate against Metcalf in the congressional primary, a guy named Erwin France. Metcalf crushed him 3-1. And that's where the Black independent political movement in Chicago really got launched in a major way. I should point out, there was a race for state's attorney in 1972. Some people may know the name Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton was the Black Panther leader in Chicago. The state's attorney ordered a police raid in which Hampton was killed, and it became pretty clear that Hampton didn't put up a heck of a lot of resistance and was basically assassinated in his bed. The state's attorney was defeated by a Republican, and the Black community galvanized around the Republican. So the 70s were a germinating place. In 1977, a state senator who was another guy who had parted with the Democratic machine, Harold Washington, ran for mayor after Daley died at the end of 1976. And Harold carried five of the predominantly Black wards. Another sign that things were changing ultimately, as you know, and you may be leading to this, Harold Washington was elected as the first Black mayor of Chicago in 1983. You were right. I could talk about Chicago politics forever.
I believe it. And in your first decade or so in Chicago, you worked in journalism. You brush shoulders with many of these personalities, political figures, most prominently at the Chicago Tribune. But once you threw the switch and began to work in politics yourself, how did that journalism background make you a different political operative than if you'd skipped that chapter of your career and hit the campaign world right away?
Zach, you are part of this world as well. So you know the most important quality that a political strategist can have, whether you're a media consultant or a pollster or a general strategist, is the ability to probe and ask questions and really understand the environment in which you're working, the nature of the candidate you're working for, and the nature of the candidates you're running against. You know, what I learned as a journalist was to ask questions. You know, I was sent to places all over the country to cover political campaigns. And I always reminded myself that whatever theories I had, the most important thing was to ask the right questions, because the theories could be wrong. That's, of course, why we do research. You know that world very well. It whetted my already intense interest in politics, but it also taught me people can be counterintuitive. Every community is different. So you may have some theories that you're bringing from another campaign, but don't try and retrofit campaign to something you did somewhere else under different circumstances, because more often than not, you'll fall short.
And so at this point, you're in your late 20s at the Chicago Tribune. You're this grizzled reporter, a product of New York City and Chicago. And yet somehow your first real date in professional politics is with an earnest, bow-tied Lutheran from downstate Troy, Illinois. Why was that the right time? And why was that the right candidate to make the professional jump into the arena?
Well, it was the right time because there were changes at my newspaper. I was lucky, Zach. I started at the Chicago Tribune as an intern 2 days after I graduated from college. I was hired as a reporter at the end of the summer. I had lost my dad when I was 19. And as I mentioned, I was sort of estranged from my mom. So, you know, when my dad died, I was sort of on my own in many ways. And that newsroom became my family, became my home. Those editors who were spectacular journalists became like parental figures to me. And then new management came in. A lot of those editors went away. And it became very clear to me that the bottom line became the bottom line in a way that it hadn't been in the first 6 years that I was there, where the story was everything and there were very few constraints in terms of resources that they were willing to spend. And I can, there's a specific couple of things that happened that prompted me to want to leave. But I knew that, I mean, I love journalism so much that I didn't want to have to practice it in ways that I thought were less than I should. And so Paul Simon was a guy who was running. He was a congressman from downstate Illinois. I had covered him. I knew him. He was running for the U.S. Senate. He actually had approached me a year earlier and tried very hard to persuade me and my wife that I should leave journalism and go to work for him. It was a difficult decision because we had a child who had chronic illness. We were struggling with that. It wasn't the right time. But by the time I made the decision, I was so disillusioned with the direction of the paper that I decided, yeah, this is a direction I want to take. Why Paul Simon? Yeah, there were a lot of things we did not have in common. The one thing we had in common was idealism. I mean, we both believed in the good that politics could do. We believed that it was the vehicle by which we could grab the wheel of history and turn it, that everybody, every American could grab the wheel of history and turn it in a better direction. The thing I knew his biography, I'd said to you before, part of what being a journalist, asking the right questions. Paul Simon was a guy who quit college when he was 19, bought a little community newspaper in Troy, Illinois, way downstate, closer to Little Rock than Chicago. He used that paper to crusade against a gambling syndicate down there that really was very much in control of the politics of the area. He tried to get people to run against their candidates. No one would. So he ran for the state legislature when he was 25 and he got elected. And when he got to the state legislature, he was a strong, strong proponent, not just for political reform, which was hard enough in Illinois in the 1950s, but for civil rights, which was incredibly hard when you come from deep southern Illinois. I was impressed by that. You know, he ultimately became the lieutenant governor of Illinois, lost a race for governor, a primary, because he wouldn't rule out a state income, or because he wouldn't denounce the Republican governor for implementing a state income tax. I just thought he was very courageous and unusual. And the main thing, Zach, is I said to myself, if you're going to leave journalism, you better leave for a guy who's where you wake up in the morning and pick up the paper and find out that he's embarrassed you. And I knew Paul Simon would never embarrass me. I knew he would make me proud.
Paul Simon's hand belongs on this throttle. He engineered the deal between business and government that brought this railroad back from abandonment.
But you wouldn't have been able to work it without having some help from government in the form of a loan to help get going, right?
Absolutely not.
Paul Simon understands how government can help business produce jobs.
It's a cooperative effort, people working together.
Yes.
And that's what the ballgame's all about.
That's what it's about. Yeah.
Congressman Paul Simon for senator, for all of Illinois.
So I made the leap and I went over there as communications director. And like within a very short time, through a series of debacles, I ended up as the campaign manager.
And that Simon campaign wasn't a huge sprawling staff, I assume. But in addition to yourself, that staff included Forrest Claypool, who'd become very influential in his own right and elected appointed positions.
Yes,
Wilhelm, who managed Clinton's 92 campaign.
And became DNC chair, yeah.
An aggressive young finance staffer named Rahm Emanuel. That's a hell of a team, right? What was the X factor that brought together so much talent so early in their career?
I think it was Paul Simon. First of all, one of the problems and one of the reasons I became manager is that we actually did have a large staff per my predecessor.
Too large of a staff.
Too large of a staff. That was one of the problems. So one of the things we had to do was rationalize the staff and move people to other political entities who could help out. And anyway, that was an organization that Wilhelm largely spearheaded. We were a group of idealists. You name a few, there were others there who went on to Henry Henderson, who became the city's environmental commissioner. I mean, there were others there. Mike Calabrese, who was a really brilliant researcher, went on to do a lot of work for organized labor. It's just an incredibly talented group of people, all under 30, drawn to Paul Simon. as I was, because they were idealists and they believed in him and they believed in the cause. And it was really a wonderful, there were two great campaigns in 1984 that were wellsprings of talent. There was ours, and there was Lloyd Doggett ran for the Senate in Texas, and James Carville ran that campaign. Paul Begala was his lieutenant. Mark McKinnon was in that campaign, I think. Kiki Moore. I mean, a whole bunch of people who would become Hall of Fame figures in American politics were in that campaign. So, yeah, it's funny how these kinds of campaigns can be wellsprings for talent. But I think it has to do with the people who are running. I mean, if the people who are running are really inspiring, idealistic people, they tend to draw inspiring, idealistic proteges.
That's interesting you raise that 1984 Texas Senate race. If people want to hear more about that race, Lloyd Doggett versus Phil Gramm in 1984, they should find the very first episode of this podcast with Paul Begala, who you mentioned, where he talks in depth about that race and the team behind it, and how he personally learned a lot from a loss in that campaign. But back to your arc, David, in this 1984 Paul Simon Senate race in Illinois, even though you were green as an operative, it's your first real campaign experience as a professional, you actually took on some of the conventional wisdom late in that 84 Senate campaign, facing off with some pretty established consultants and put your stamp on the closing message of the Simon campaign. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. You know, Bob Squire was our media consultant. Carter Eskew was the guy who worked in the campaign. David Doak, who went on to be a great media consultant in his own right, as did Carter, worked some on that campaign. But, you know, the conventional wisdom in politics is when in doubt, attack. And this was a very close race. We were running against Charles Percy, a three-term incumbent, and in many ways a very laudable figure, also a kind of moderate to liberal Republican and certainly a reform-minded guy. But he got caught up in the fear. He saw a bunch of moderate Republicans defeated from 78 to 84 through the Reagan Revolution and so on. And so he really started shifting positions on things like school prayer and some other issues. And he became a stalwart defender of Reagan. That lost him a lot of moderate support, but didn't win him conservative support. So he had vulnerabilities. We had a debate late in the campaign, and Squire, who is really a towering figure in American media, so one of the founding fathers of modern media consulting, and very clever and very smart. And he prepped Simon with a bunch of attack lines. And Simon had been pushed around by Percy in a few debates and was up for it. And it was a bloodbath, that debate. I remember Simon saying to Percy, they both had hearing issues, and Simon said, "Chuck, I'll tell you what, I'll turn up my hearing aid if you turn up yours," complaining about how Percy was interpreting one of his answers. And just was it. And it was, you know, the thing about Paul Simon that everybody would say is he was just a warm, nice, decent guy. So Simon as attack machine was not, I mean, I was uncomfortable with it as it played out. And when we polled afterwards, we had just, our support had just plummeted. And I told those guys, I think we need to actually go positive, that we need to remind people why they like Paul Simon. And I worked on a script with Carter Eskew. It was a direct-to-camera in which, I wish I could recall the full script now, but essentially the message was, this is what I believe in government. I believe in its power to help people. Some people call me old-fashioned. Some people say that makes me old-fashioned, but I don't mind. And the line I contributed that I felt was important was, I don't mind. I'd rather lose with dignity than stand for nothing. I want to be a senator you can count on. Well, those lines to me were very important because that was our comparative advantage over Percy, that whatever you thought about Simon, you knew where he stood. He stood on principle. He was going to stand on principle to the end. But Squire was very opposed to running that ad. And there was a huge battle. And, you know, Simon ultimately went with me on this. So we split. We went 50% that spot and 50% an attack spot. And we started climbing. We ended up winning by 88,000 votes as Reagan was carrying the state for the Republicans by 500,000. And we won, by the way, 25% of the self-proclaimed conservatives. So we ran an ad in which Simon embraced liberalism and yet got 25% of the self-identified conservatives because they bought that message.
And at that point, you're pretty much off and running as an operative, shortly becoming a media consultant for the next 20 plus years.
Yeah.
Over that time, what was unique about a David Axelrod TV spot or overall media approach that would have been different, that was different than the other media consultants around at the time?
Well, look, Zach, first of all, there were a lot of good media consultants who did great work. And my work probably evolved over time because I did 150 campaigns and you learn things from each. But the thing that I felt most strongly about, and you can hear echoes of this in things I said earlier, is I think that authenticity is really important and that whatever your message is, it should be rooted in a biography. It should be people have a high bullshit meter for politics and political ads. And they need to know that what they're hearing from someone is genuine. So I put a lot of stock in tying biography to issue positions that a candidate took. And I think if there was anything that is a through line between my work from the beginning to the end, that was it.
And is there a race, a moment in the 80s and the 90s you look back on as a media consultant and you think, okay, I've got this sort of figured out now. I'm coming into my own as a media consultant.
You know, I mean, there were races along the way. I ended up working for Harold Washington when he ran for re-election in 1987. And he started off behind the former mayor, Jane Byrne, in the primary. And we had a hammer and tong battle there. And then in the general, that was a race that taught me a lot about working for an African-American candidate who was a first-time office holder in a mostly white venue. I ended up doing 17 big city mayor's races around the country, often for African-American candidates. Obviously, I worked for Barack Obama. I worked for Deval Patrick. So there were some lessons there that were really important. I'd say, you know, another race that I really loved and was in 1998, I worked for a young state senator named Tom Vilsack, who everybody now knows he's in his second tour of duty as agriculture secretary, now under Biden, first under Obama. But he was running for governor. He wanted to run for governor of Iowa. And there was a candidate who was very much favored by the Democratic establishment and had all the money who was running in that primary. And we started off 20 points behind and wound up winning that primary. And then we had to run a general election. There hadn't been a Democrat governor in Iowa in 32 years. We were running against a former congressman named Jim Ross Lightfoot. Every smart person in Iowa in politics thought this was a quixotic race on our part. And we started off again, you know, like 20 points behind, but we were able to tie Lightfoot to the Newt Gingrich majority in Congress, which was highly, highly unpopular on issues like Social Security and Medicare, by the way. At the same time, Vilsack, who's a very earnest guy, you know, he had an extraordinary personal story of being orphaned, and his mother had mental health issues, and his father ended up selling everything they owned to send him to college. And there was an earnestness to Vilsack. And there was a race, too, Zach, where the conventional wisdom, the issue that always sunk Democrats in Iowa was opposition to the death penalty. That was an issue that everybody feared. I mean, it didn't always sink them, but it was always an issue the Republicans ran. It was a troubling issue to some swing voters. And at the end of the day, Lightfoot ran ads attacking, they were poorly done, but attacking Vilsack on this issue. And I got advice from high-ranking officials in Iowa, whose names I won't mention, that we had to hit really hard on the crime issue and hit Lightfoot on the crime issue. And I told him, listen, man, if we fight it out on this turf, we're probably going to lose. So we put Vilsack on the air, direct to camera in a response spot. He said, and I can't remember the exact script, but the essence of it was, in the past few days, you've seen ads from my opponent that I find tasteless as a husband and a father. And he said, well, that may be how Mr. Lightfoot thinks he's going to get elected governor, but I have a different idea. And we went back to our message, which is all about middle-class economics. And at the end, he said, my opponent's counting on 11th hour smears to win this campaign. I'm counting on you. And we ended up winning the race by 5 points.
In the final days of this campaign, you've seen a lot of wild charges, outrageous lies, and tasteless TV and radio ads that are offensive to me as a husband and a father. Well, maybe that's how Jim Lightfoot plans to get elected governor, but I have a different idea. I'm going to keep on talking about how we educate our kids, about tax cuts for working families, about protecting the rights of Iowans in HMOs. Mr. Lightfoot's counting on 11th hour mudslinging to carry the day. I'm counting on you.
That was a very confidence-inspiring race, more so 4 years later, because almost every Democratic governor who was elected in 98 lost because the country was in recession, and Iowa was. We were behind by 9 points when we started that race, and we ended up winning by 9. My buddy Mike Murphy was on the other side of that race, a brilliant, brilliant media consultant. We had gone against each other in another governor's race in Iowa that he won. There were a lot of nuances to that race that were really fun. But Vilsack, he was a great client, and that was a great race. And that period from 98 to the end of my career, which was basically 2012, that I felt very much in command at that point.
And Harold Washington has come up a time or two. Do you have a favorite Harold Washington story that speaks to his personality, what made him unique?
My goodness. For all your listeners, I don't know whether it's been released yet or what, but there is a wonderful documentary that a Chicago filmmaker has made about Harold Washington called Punch 9 for Harold Washington. Anybody who cares about politics should watch this, because he was the most he was right up there with Obama and some of the greats I've worked with in terms of his charisma and power. And in his case, pure joyfulness. He just loved the combat of politics, but in a very joyful way. We won this primary, as I mentioned, against Jane Byrne. We were in this anteroom or a small meeting room in the mayor's office because he was going to hold a press conference afterwards. And Harold said, everybody's very happy. And Harold said, well, how much of the white vote did I get? And someone said, well, you got 21% of the white vote. And Harold said, I've tried to be a great mayor for the whole city. I probably spent 75% of my time in those white neighborhoods, and we get 21% of the white vote, and we're all happy about it. And the guy said, well, we only got 8% last time. And Harold smiled wanly, and he said, ain't it a bitch to be a black man in the land of the free and the home of the brave? That was actually, he grew up in the segregated army. He fought for he reclaimed his dignity from a machine that had him voting against the interests of his own community on issues like open housing, and he couldn't take it anymore. And, he burned with this passion for social equity and justice. Then he went out and he held this press conference, and people were asking him about this. He had to run a general election campaign, too, and there were a number of candidates running against him. And there was one who was viewed as the front runner, who was a colleague of his in the state Senate. And he said, he's not even going to be there at the end. And everybody was like stunned because the guy was leading in the polls. So like, what are you talking about? He said, I've served with him. I know the man. I've looked in his eyes. And a reporter said, and what did you see? And Harold said, they were closed. And of course, he went on and won that race over. He was just an incredible character. One of my great regrets in life is that Harold Washington didn't live long enough to know Barack Obama, and Obama didn't get to know him, because I think they would have been great friends. Harold was, he was a street fighting, brawling politician, but he was this really eloquent and scholarly guy whose books were floor to ceiling books. And so he could traverse those worlds, and he and Obama would have been incredible friends.
I'm grateful for your support on primary day, and I'm proud that people from every neighborhood joined our cause. Together, we voted against the old divisions. We voted for a city government that's open, that works for all Chicagoans, and not just a handful of insiders. There are still a few machine politicians who want to turn the clock back. They've even left the Democratic Party to make one last stand. They're looking back, We're looking forward to what we can do together for our city in the next 4 years.
Last race I wanted to ask you about today is the 1992 Senate race. I'll just set the stage and pitch it to you. This is the wake of the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court hearings, credible allegations that Thomas sexually harassed Anita Hill, I guess when they were both working at the Justice Department. This galvanizes many women, many Democrats nationally, yet longtime Democratic incumbent senator from Illinois, Al Dixon, votes to confirm Thomas. At that point, you spring into action. What might have been an otherwise an incumbent cruising through the primary turns into one of the most important Senate primaries of all time because of a Supreme Court vote and because political consultant David Axelrod decides there ought to be an opening here for a challenger. That's a pretty gutsy thing to do, right? Take on a sitting senator?
Yeah, it wasn't particularly well received by a lot of the political establishment. But the thing that bothered me, Alan Dixon was a very, very good politician in Illinois. He had been state senator, state treasurer, secretary of state. And he had an unerring nose for the middle of the road. But in this case, he was one of four votes for Clarence Thomas. And shortly after he cast the vote for Clarence Thomas, the most formidable candidate for the Senate on the Republican side in Illinois dropped out. And it seemed to me like maybe he had cut a deal. And ultimately, this was confirmed in a book that Jane Mayer wrote about the Thomas. I think Jill Abramson co-wrote it with her about the Thomas confirmation that he went out golfing with Dan Quayle and they cut a deal on the vote. So this deeply offended me. And I thought he should have a challenger. And I had persuaded a guy I knew because I had worked for the second Mayor Daley. And through that, I got to know a trial lawyer named Al Hofeld, who's become a dear friend of mine. And I suggested that he run in the primary. And we ran a very well-funded campaign, but it opened the door for Carol Moseley Braun, who was the county recorder of deeds at the time, but a prominent Black politician in Chicago to run. And of course, she was well positioned, a Black woman after the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearing. And she, by dint of the battle between Dixon and Hofeld, she became the nominee of the Democratic Party. Late in that campaign, she ran into a whole bunch of problems. And a race that should have been a walk away suddenly was close. And they asked me to come in and do some ads for her. And apropos to the thing I said before about putting someone on the air, sometimes the candidate is the best person to diffuse a bad situation. Carol Moseley Braun was terrific direct to camera. You know, I wanted to do an ad that reminded people of why they liked her in the first place. She did this ad. Again, I can't recall the entire script, but it was basically saying, when we started this race, people said this was a dream that could never happen or something like that. You know, well, now we're here, you know, and I'm still fighting for this and this and this. The close was something like, I'm Carol Moseley Braun. And there was something about, you know, I believe in an America where X, Y, and Z, and where even impossible dreams can come true. And it was really, she did a wonderful job on it. She won that race. She ultimately was kind of a tragic figure. She sort of self-immolated in that office. But it was quite an accomplishment. She was the first Black woman in the United States Senate. Very, very talented, just a little bit flawed.
As an aside, Senator Carol Moseley Braun is a former guest on this podcast, as was one of her top advisors on that race, Jerry Austin. I'd encourage folks at home to find those episodes in the archives to hear more about this race. To this day, Jerry Austin still refers to Al Hofeld simply as, quote, the Axelrod candidate. And going deeper on this 1992 Senate race, I think it's a Mark Twain quote that history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. And in 2004, there's a very similar U.S. Senate primary, a three-candidate field comprised of a rich guy, comprised of a longtime, well-connected political figure, and also comprised of a telegenic, fresh-faced young Black candidate. In 2004, that candidate was Barack Obama. You were working with him at this point. Yeah. What lessons from 92 race did you learn that were relevant 12 years later in the 2004 Obama Senate win?
First of all, there were seven candidates in that race, although the three you mentioned were the leading contenders. One of the things I learned was basic math, and I thought we could count on 24-25% of the electorate would be African American, and I thought we could count on 90% of that vote. And I thought that, as Carol Moseley Braun did, I thought we could appeal to progressive white voters on the lakefront in Chicago and some of the suburban areas and some of the college towns and put together what we thought we would need, which is about 38% of the vote. Well, Obama, who started off as kind of considered a third-tier candidate because his name was Barack Hussein Obama. This was 1 year after he started running in 2002, 1 year after the 9/11 attack. So the name Barack Hussein Obama, the conventional wisdom was he couldn't win. He was such a beguiling, inspiring presence at a time when the country was very much divided over the war, roiled in its politics. This guy seemed like an antidote to some of that. And he just ended up, he swept. One of the things he did was he got almost every newspaper endorsement, which certainly then was a really important thing for an African-American candidate. So people who needed reassurance or a permission structure, white voters, they found it in the fact that he was so highly reviewed. But he also just presented well. And even though we got outspent by the rich guy 5-1, Obama ended up it was stunning to all of us, but he got 53% of the vote in a 7-person primary. And he, of course, ended up winning the general election by 50 points.
Just one non-political question as we wind down. I've heard you mention before that for many years you suffered from periodic bouts of self-doubt that could become a struggle for you. I think a lot of us in politics, which is very high stakes, even in lower profile races, the stakes are often very high in human terms. What did you figure out over the years in your own life about grappling with that kind of issue?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that imposter syndrome is something that runs rampant in our business, in our industry, if you want to call the political consulting business. And I always kind of bristled at the idea that it was a business, even though it was how I made my living, but I never got into it because of the potential for making money. I thought it was a vehicle to do the thing I loved, which is to be involved in politics, help good people get elected. But it's a competition of very smart people, as you say, very high stakes. There is something I call in the political consultant world the Wizard of Oz syndrome, where a consultant comes in. Squire was great at this. Basically, the pitch he made, even though it was not articulated in just this way, is, it's like, I've got 37 members of the United States Senate, and you're going to be number 38. And the basic message is, you can't lose if you hire me. Like, I have the magic. I have the secret sauce. And I was never very good at that kind of pitch. But you knew that people were reposing their trust in you, that their careers, their lives in you, and that you would be judged in the political consulting world based on how you did it. And I lived with that imposter syndrome. What if I'm not as smart as I think? What if I'm not as good as I think? What if I didn't choose the right words here or the right spot, all of that. I lived with that a lot. I mean, look, success has something to do with quelling that. But the bigger thing is, and the thing I would like to stress to you as a young person or a younger person and to anyone, not just in this walk of life, but any competitive walk of life, is there are more important things. There are more important things than professional success. And I learned that lesson very, very late. And I wish I had learned it earlier. I have the most spectacular wife, my wife, Susan, 43 years we've been married. And I have three great kids, one of whom, Lauren, has struggled with epilepsy and the impacts of epilepsy all her life. There was a time early in our lives together when I was so intent on pursuing success, first in journalism and then in politics, that I wasn't the father or husband I should have been. What I find now is they are the foundation on which everything rests. And as long as that foundation is there, nothing is so dreadful that you can't survive it. So that's one lesson. And the other is, if you don't feel, and I say this to candidates, if you can't handle winning and losing, don't get in this game. Don't run for office. Don't become a consultant, because there are always going to be good days and bad. And I always like to say, you're never as smart as you look when you win, and you're never as dumb as you look when you lose.
Well, I appreciate you speaking to that. And let's end on this. You're not a native, but you're now synonymous with Chicago politics. Big Bill Thompson, Richard Daley, Harold Washington, David Axelrod. The next time people come to Chicago, is there a political site or two they should make a point to see, a Chicago must-see for a political junkie?
Oh, well, that's really, you should walk through the lobby of City Hall and understand all the sort of good and bad that has happened in those corridors. There are plenty of people who gave up terms in public office and began terms in federal penitentiaries because of conversations that happened in those corridors, but also some of the most luminescent figures in American political history, Richard J. Daley, Harold Washington, we've mentioned them, Rich Daley himself, Daley's son, Rahm Emanuel, who became mayor of Chicago. I mean, they patrolled those corridors. It's worth passing through there. If you take the architectural tour along the river, you'll pass the site where the wigwam was, where Abraham Lincoln accepted the Republican nomination for president. If you go down the Lakeshore Drive south, there is a monument that's partially hidden and probably deeply controversial. I think it's still there, to Stephen Douglas, who was a senator from Illinois and ran against Lincoln, both for senator and president, who had a different view on the issue of slavery. So there is that. Tell your listeners, I'll pass along some further ideas, and you can post them.
Absolutely. Well, this could not have been more enjoyable. David Axelrod, thanks so much for your time today.
It's great to be with you, Zach. I appreciate your passion for politics. I appreciate the work that you do in politics, and I appreciate the research that you did for this conversation.
Thanks for listening to the Pro Politics Podcast. Please subscribe so you can access each episode first thing every Tuesday morning. And if you're so inclined, leave a rating and a short review on your podcast app to help more people find this podcast. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook for updates on upcoming guests. Thanks for listening.